Welcome to Thrive On Life, a program dedicated to helping people with cancer live fuller lives. Today we're talking with Sally Foley, Director of the University of Michigan Center for Sexual Health. We're going to discuss what people with cancer should expect to face when they're headed back into the bedroom. Sally, first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up in this field?
Back in the 1980s, I was a cancer social worker, and the university approached me and said, would you be interested in helping put together a sexual health counseling program for the sexual health concerns and needs for any individual who has had an illness and been treated for it here? And of course, that expanded also to include in the community people who just had questions about their sexual functioning or sexual difficulties, realized that University of Michigan has one of everything, so they must have something for sexual dysfunction. So not only do we see people referred from all of the branches of medicine, but also people call in from the community and come as individuals or couples with concerns about sexual health.
You're the author of Sex Matters for Women, A Complete Guide to Taking Care of Your Sexual Self. Talk a little bit about how the book came about.
My colleagues, Sally Cope and Dennis Segrew, and I noticed that although there were some good books about men and sexual functioning, there was no really good A to Z book on women and sexual health. And so we, in a moment of great enthusiasm, said, well, let's write one. And so it took us about 5 years to write it. And that book came out in 2002. It's received really good feedback, both critically and also from the public. In Sex Matters for Women, we talk not only about what is your sexual identity, how does your body work physiologically, what are the challenges that can happen to your body, how does your partner's body work, what are some couples' communication issues? But also we address issues related to illness, disability, pain, and trauma. And unfortunately, in cancer treatment, you can have feelings related to illness, disability, pain, and trauma. It's very traumatizing to go through a diagnosis in some cancer treatments. So we've received feedback from people with cancer that they have found the book helpful to them.
This can be kind of a rough topic for people to talk about. Can you tell us, generally, how cancer can affect sexual functioning?
Everybody is born in a sexual body. We are actually sexual beings. It's located on our brainstem. It's the drive for sex is located near the drive for hunger. It's a very stubborn drive, a very stubborn appetite. And so it is with us literally from before we're born, the physiology of sexual response, until we die. People are orgasmic well into their 90s. So what happens is that an illness can affect our sexual response, but usually the illness affects us temporarily during the immediate aftermath of diagnosis and treatment.
I don't think most people are used to talking about sex in a clinical sense. Can you give us some background on what's involved in the sexual response cycle?
We think of it in three ways. First of all, desire. Is a person interested in lovemaking? Are they interested in sexual arousal or orgasm? Not everyone is. Then the second thing is arousal. So we have desire, now we have arousal. Arousal are all the physiologic things that happen in a person's body related to sexual functioning. One of the things that happens in arousal is that about 7 times the blood flows to the genital region in order for there to be an increase in sensory threshold in order to achieve an orgasm. So we have desire, interest in getting into the bedroom, arousal, the physiologic things that happen in a person's body, and orgasm, reaching a certain sensory threshold that then results in the sensation of orgasm, which are muscular contractions that occur in the genital region for both men and women. They're very similar.
Let's take the first part of that cycle. I think most would agree that cancer and sexual desire aren't really things that you think about together too often.
With a cancer diagnosis, what usually happens is a perhaps low sexual desire triggered by either the anxiety and worry related to the cancer diagnosis or triggered by fatigue. Fatigue is like the number one kick in the gut for your sex life after cancer. Because going through these kinds of treatments, they're very exhausting, they take your energy, they take your time, and also you're worried after a cancer diagnosis. So it's very normal to have a temporary low sexual desire.
So what can people do if they're at a stage where they're interested in sex again, but they just can't seem to find that sense of desire?
Interestingly enough, we've discovered that for people who do have, in general, a sense that sexuality is a very positive thing in their life and they enjoy it, that even if they're not having desire per se, maybe because of a lot of fatigue, if they'll go into the bedroom and begin to touch and rub in order to get some of the physiologic responses communicated to the brain, that their desire will follow. So sometimes we say, well, if you're interested in it but you don't really feel desire, you can, with your partner, go in the bedroom and begin to touch, touch, rub, rub, kiss, kiss, and your brain stem, which may have gotten a little sleepy, will go, oh yeah, I remember, I like this stuff. Oh yeah, okay, this is good, keep going. So sometimes we say you have to do some things before you actually feel them, and then as you feel them, you want to do them more. In essence, it's not all that different from if you enjoy your work or you enjoy a particular appointment that you have, the alarm goes off. Initially you think, oh, do I have to get out of this nice warm bed? I don't really want to, but hey, if I do, I actually really love it when I get to work. Or I'll actually feel really good when I get on the road and see my kids or visit with that good friend. So often we do a lot of things by being scheduled or having an appointment for them that at the moment we're reminded of them, we may not feel it, but if we start to do it, then later we feel it.
How can you regain your sense of desire?
Let me start by saying some people don't lose desire. People have a variety of reactions to sexual responsivity. We think part of this might be how people were raised, and we think also some of it may also be genetically, that some people are simply higher drive than other people. But people in general will say, I used to have desire, but it's gone away. I think it's important during active cancer treatment for people to give themselves a lot of flexibility and a lot of permission to let sexuality be whatever it is. During this period of time, while you're in active treatment, what I recommend to people is to concentrate on feeling good about their body, feeling good about how they look, and doing things that improve their sense of self-esteem about their presentation.
Can you share some of that advice, especially for those who've finished treatment but aren't quite at the point where they're ready to go back to the bedroom?
If before somebody thought that a new outfit or a really, really cool jacket was optional, they should treat themselves and think of it as a necessity, that looking good is important. How we feel about ourselves is influenced by that. But the other thing is that people need to give themselves permission to widen their sense about what looks good. The first thing one can do in terms of feeling good about oneself is to postpone having to fit some stereotyped image about do I feel sexual desire, and instead focus on do I feel good about myself and my body image, and then to move toward magazines and looks that create a more positive sense of self. The second thing is to not stop being touched. Touch in general is very good for our brain. Our brain makes a very positive neurochemical called oxytocin when we're being touched or cuddled or we're snuggling in a way that's comfortable and cozy for us. If people have a permanent partner, they need to talk with their permanent partner about continuing to cuddle and snuggle, even if they're not particularly interested in being sexual, because it's good for your brain and it's good for your health.
For a lot of cancer patients, there's more going on than just a lack of desire. Can you talk a little bit about the physiology of arousal and how cancer treatment can compromise that?
Arousal difficulties usually have to do with something that is compromised in the way that we get turned on. We have a nervous system that responds when our nerve endings are touched or stimulated in a certain way. The nervous system triggers our brain and says, hey, great things are happening around here. We have a cardiovascular system that says, ooh, heart, put some blood down in that genital region. Then we have to have muscular responses to trigger those orgasms. And we have to have hormones, some hormonal levels of, for women, estrogen and testosterone, and for men, primarily testosterone. We have to have hormonal levels that will help our nervous system and our cardiovascular system all respond. So it's a very intricate balance between these different human body systems. The one that is primarily affected, though, in arousal phase is the cardiovascular. People just don't feel that swelling response in their genital region. For men, what they notice in terms of the swelling response is that they have erectile difficulties. Their penis just does not get as engorged with blood, or it might immediately have an erection, and then they lose that erection too quickly. For women, what they'll say is they just don't feel that sense of fullness or genital swelling. And actually what's happening, if you could look internally, the walls of the vagina are lined with the same spongy tissue that's inside the penis. So the spongy tissue in the walls of the vagina don't engorge with blood and create a sense of pleasurable fullness and also a sense of lubrication. The walls of the vagina in the upper two-thirds of the vagina, literally the walls sweat, tiny little beads of perspiration called lubricant or vaginal mucus. And that's caused by these walls in the vagina engorging, the blood vessels engorge with blood, it pushes the vaginal mucus through the walls or the lining of the vagina, and that's what lubrication is caused by. When a woman is on a lot of the different kinds of treatment for cancer, she experiences vaginal dryness.
Okay, so how does cancer treatment interfere in this?
Both men and women can experience hormonal differences with decreased testosterone for men and decreased estrogen or estrogen and testosterone for women. Decreased estrogen for women actually impairs some of the ability of these blood vessels to engorge with blood and cause this vaginal lubrication. And also some medications are what we call anticholinergic. Cholinergic means swelling or sort of juicy, full of moisture. Anticholinergic, those medicines are like what you take for hay fever. Those are anticholinergic. Well, guess what? Chemotherapies are anticholinergics. They're drying. So a lot of times women will say, oh, in terms of my sexual response, I can have interest if I'm rested enough and I don't have fatigue. I can have interest and desire. But you know what? Arousal, I just can't get the mojo working. And what they're really referring to is they've had a drying response to the chemotherapy or the radiation treatment. They're not getting that great blood flow to the genital region because the meds they're on literally are compromising that blood flow. By the way, temporarily compromising that blood flow. For most people, once they're 6 months to a year past chemotherapy treatment, all of these things will return for them. But the lubrication difficulties tend to be ones where people don't engorge with blood in their genital region. So for men, what they experience it as is an erectile difficulty, and for women, what they experience it as, the fancy term is female sexual arousal disorder, FSAD, but the real life way to talk about it is, hey, I just don't lubricate, I don't get as wet as I used to, and it's dry, and it leads to painful penetration or painful sex.
What can people do to address this pain?
Men and women can have pain on arousal, and sometimes that's actually caused by a confluence, a conversion of a couple of different medicines together. So sometimes if people say, oh my goodness, suddenly getting aroused is painful for me now, it never used to be, we want to start by looking at the physician's PDR and understanding, are you on a medicine for your cancer treatment or for perhaps for treatment of snoring or for perhaps for the treatment of depression or anxiety? Are you on any other kind of medicine that in conjunction with that medicine is causing some pelvic pain or pain on arousal? In terms of cancer diagnosis and treatment, the most common thing that we would see would be this thing called dyspareunia, where it's painful to have arousal or perhaps painful to have intercourse, but usually intercourse continues to be possible. And in terms of treatment, one of our first lines of defense, of course, is to really increase the use of lubrications.
Can you tell us a little bit about lubricants and when it might be appropriate to use one?
Lubrications get a bad rap. People act like lubricant, using a lube, is somehow a failure of the couple to adequately get each other aroused. In fact, if you look where lubrication for women comes from, it's the upper third of the vagina. Well, that means that when people are initiating sexual activity with each other, it would really be a good idea to use lubricant because it's going to take, what with gravity, etc., a little while for the lubrication to get down to the opening of the vagina. So we try to suggest to people that they use something called water-based lubricants.
What's the difference between a water-based lubricant and the other ones that are out there? And why would somebody want to use a water-based lubricant?
I'll tell you when not to use water-based lubricants first. Water-based lubricants are things like KY jelly, personal lube, Astroglide. Water-based lubricants, we suggest those because they don't break down condoms. And one thing that people who've been diagnosed with cancer should know is that a cancer diagnosis does not protect you from any other kind of diagnosis, like a sexually transmitted infection or a sexually transmitted disease. You can get those too on top of having a cancer diagnosis and treatment. So we really encourage people to use condoms. And you want to use a lubricant with condoms where the lubricant doesn't break down the condom. And there's some literature that suggests that using Vaseline, which is petroleum-based, would break down the use of a condom.
Okay, so I think we also need to ask then, when would you not want to use a water-based lubricant?
If people are actually in a permanent partnership, trying to get pregnant, so they're not using condoms, and they are post-cancer diagnosis and treatment, you might not want to use a water-based lubricant because they tend to have a little bit of spermicidal in them sometimes, or they can have a little bit of detergent in them or a little bit of glycerin, and these things actually could potentially prevent fertility. So if you're in a permanent partnership, your post-cancer diagnosis and treatment, and you're trying to get pregnant, you're obviously not going to be using condoms, and you can go right ahead and use baby oil. Baby oil is a fine product to use for lubrication, and it doesn't in any way inhibit sperm and their motility.
How would you recommend someone use a lubricant in this situation?
In using a lubrication, you would use it topically at the beginning of sexual activity, and you would place it around the opening of the vagina on the inner labia. That's the inner lips of the vulva. The outer lips or the outer labia are actually fleshy and they have pubic hair on them. The inner lips are what we call a mucous membrane, which is the same as the inside of your mouth. Incidentally, that's why women are more susceptible to getting sexually transmitted infections, is because instead of having skin for genitals, they actually have a mucous membrane for genitals. So their vagina and their inner labia have the same porousness that the mouth has. So it's very good to keep that very moist. It keeps it from getting cracked or getting tiny little irritation spots. What we might call that sensation of like a little sunburn feeling or a little rug burn feeling is a very uncomfortable thing in a vagina or labia. And so using lubrication helps that a great deal.
Do you typically see cancer patients who have trouble achieving orgasm?
Orgasm phase difficulties are ones where people are not experiencing orgasm at all, and maybe they never have. Or sometimes they are only able to experience orgasm in certain situations, but not in others. So maybe a person was able to have an orgasm through having their partner penetrate them, which incidentally, for women, about 33% of women have orgasm during intercourse. The other 67% of women have to have some sort of manual or oral stimulation of their clitoris or of their labia to have orgasm. So when we talk about orgasm, sometimes women wonder, well, I'm experiencing orgasm, but not during intercourse. Is this a problem? And in fact, only 33% of women actually routinely have orgasm during intercourse. That's probably one of the big myths that we know about what people understand about sexual functioning. So sometimes this drying effect of chemotherapy won't create enough blood flow and swelling for there to be an increase in the sensory threshold coming up for women so that they can reach orgasm. So they'll say, well, I have desire and I get a little bit of a feeling of tingling or swelling, but not enough to be able to have an orgasm. And that's a very normal and usually very temporary response in sexual functioning during chemotherapy treatment.
Let's talk about men for a minute. Can cancer treatment cause rapid ejaculation?
In men, ejaculation and orgasm happen so simultaneously for men that they think that they're the same thing, but they're actually two very separate mechanisms. So men can have orgasms even if they're not having ejaculation. A very common thing that happens for men with some prostate cancer treatments is to have what we call retrograde ejaculation. What that means is that a man does not have ejaculation occur through his penis and out, so he doesn't see fluid. His orgasm can occur, but the ejaculate is back into the bladder, and so his seminal fluid is ejaculated into the bladder where it gets mixed with urine and excreted out as urine. And some men think because they're not ejaculating, they'll never be orgasmic again. And that's a myth. That's wrong. Men can easily learn to be orgasmic without ejaculation. So men can have a delayed ejaculation and they can have too rapid ejaculation. In my knowledge, there are no cancer treatments that would cause rapid ejaculation, too rapid ejaculation. So what is called rapid ejaculation or premature ejaculation usually is present for a man before a cancer diagnosis and is usually, if anything, affected by the cancer treatment in terms of delaying his ejaculation a little bit because of that drying thing I talked about, that anticholinergic thing.
What about patients who have had to have genital surgery?
They can have orgasms even if the penis has been removed, just as women can continue to be orgasmic even if their clitoris has to be removed for vulvar cancer. We can teach people how to use other nerve endings in the genital region and stimulate those nerve endings to orgasm.
So when should someone start to think about sex again after cancer treatment?
When a person is about 3 months post-chemotherapy and post-radiation, they often begin to ask the question, where's my horniness? Where's my sex drive? Where's my sense of desire? I think 3 months is too early. When I work with most people, they say it returns sometime after 6 months to a year. Longer if they continue to have a lot of pain vaginally. So in terms of desire returning, we really ask that people give themselves a break psychologically and wait.
Can you give us some tips on how to help that process along?
Interestingly enough, exercise is not only the fountain of youth, it is the elixir of love. And so if people will get regular exercise, and I do not mean you have to go out and be Lance Armstrong, you can get regular exercise by taking your dog for walks around the block, doing it several times a day. You can get regular exercise by taking the stairs instead of elevators. You can get regular exercise by pushing yourself to do some laps of the mall. So anything that gets your body up and walking is good exercise. And if you'll get your body up and walking up something like stairs or a hill, that's good exercise too. So you've got to increase your exercise. No question about it, it's the elixir of love. A third thing that actually helps desire is to really work to accept yourself. It turns out that a lack of self-acceptance really gets in the way of healthy sexual functioning. Lack of self-acceptance is about being too critical of your body image, too critical of what you expect to get done in a day or a week, carrying baggage around. So working on accepting yourself for who you are, accepting yourself for where you are in your life, and then working to clean out your attic of old baggage and clean out your basement of old baggage and clean out your brain of old baggage. So dump the old stuff so that you can make room for the new. Another thing you can do in relationship to this is to develop friendships. Gossip is good for you. It actually increases certain neuroreceptors in terms of their healthy use of oxytocin and vasopressin. It actually increases serotonin, which is part of your feel-good neurochemical in the brain. When you get together with other people and tell stories and laugh and spend time with friends, you're increasing your mood, increasing self-esteem, and that will have a positive influence on desire.
What else can people do to sort of jumpstart their mood again?
Number one, get touched regularly in ways that are pleasurable, to get that from friends in terms of hugs and back rubs and hand-holding, to get that from your partner in terms of all-over sensory body massage, to give that to yourself by standing in the shower or in the bath longer and letting the water flow over your body and feel that flow and allowing your hands to trail over your body comfortably on parts of your body that feel good to be touched, and then also professionally to consider massage.
A cancer diagnosis can stir a lot of emotions. As we all know, anxiety is probably chief among them. What's its role in all of this?
Anxiety can be a great dampener of desire, arousal, or orgasm. And when a person has a cancer diagnosis, one of the things that happens is they get worried. That's a very normal response. In fact, I think as a healthcare professional, I would be concerned about a person who didn't show some worry about a cancer diagnosis. So it's not the first thing we think about after a cancer diagnosis. How is my sex life affected? That comes much later. When we get a cancer diagnosis, the first thing a person thinks about is, am I going to live? Is my life going to be okay? Later, after getting information about treatment and about how to live, then people say, you know what I want? I want a restoration of normalcy. I want as much normal as possible. And sexual functioning, healthy sexual functioning, is about quality of life. And quality of life is what we're all about in our cancer care. We want people to have a maximum quality of life, and so we care about their sexual functioning in relationship to that. Often what we have to tell people is, you may have to weather some storms in your sexual life, and I have some advice about how to weather those storms. Eventually, you should be able to get back a new normal where you have full sexual functioning.
In your experience, do you think that people tend to have higher expectations for their sex life than maybe what's reasonable?
We know that cancer treatment isn't going to make your life more sexy. It's going to be a hit on your sexual functioning. So we need to ask you, what was sex like before your cancer diagnosis? A cancer diagnosis can have a kind of obliterating effect in terms of people's memory. And again, this is very normal. It is such a big deal to have to deal with cancer that people often romanticize or idealize what it was like before. So early on in cancer treatment, we like to be able to talk with people about, what has your sexual functioning been like up to this point? Often, because people have very, very busy lives, or maybe because they've had some stress with their partner, or maybe they're not comfortable with self-stimulation and they haven't been with a partner, often people haven't had a great sex life even before the cancer diagnosis. And cancer diagnosis is not going to put in great sex into your life. Now, you can work toward a really good sex life, but your sexual responsivity is going to respond to the same kinds of things that you use in other parts of your life. So if you're used to working hard on exercise, working hard on maintaining good friendships or good relationships with your kids or your partner, and you understand that getting a lot of good information and then working hard on things leads to something getting better, then your sex life can get better too.
Okay, let's talk about some myths. You mentioned to me before that people have a lot of misconceptions in this area. Let's go with this one first. After diagnosis, people are so grateful to be alive that they aren't interested in sex anymore.
People after cancer diagnosis are understandably interested in getting educated and informed and getting the best possible treatment that they can get for cancer. They're also very interested in getting information and education about how to help their families deal with their cancer diagnosis. And people are enormously inventive and committed to cancer treatments. After treatment, people are interested in having a full life. Sexuality is a quality of life issue, and it is a myth that people aren't interested in sex after cancer. They're very interested, they just don't know where to go to get information to help themselves and their partners.
How about this one? Myth number two. Doctors love to talk to patients about sex.
That is a total myth. Doctors are as uncomfortable talking about sex as everybody else is. Physicians get very little information in medical school about healthy sexual functioning and the treatment of sexual dysfunction. What they learn to do is refer it to a sex therapist. The problem is there aren't that many sex therapists trained, certified, and available to physicians in their communities. It's a very unique, difficult to find subspecialty. So doctors are uncomfortable, they don't get a lot of information about it, and they bring to it all their own upbringing and perhaps lack of sex education. One doctor joked with me and said, "I think I became a doctor because I wanted to learn about biology and healthy sexual information." He said, "When my tooth fell out and I was 7 years old, I woke up in the morning, the tooth fairy had left me a quarter and a book about sex." He said, "So I learned my first information about sex from the tooth fairy." So doctors come at sexual information with the same kind of misconceptions, lack of information that the rest of us come at it with. They're not comfortable talking about sex with their patients. Also, doctors have very little time in the room, and there's so many things they need to cover in terms of the disease and the treatment that often sex gets pushed aside. I work with doctors, though, on three little words. Those three little words, how is sex? Because I say to docs, if you can get those three words out, often people will give you their questions. And if they give you their questions, then you can Google me or email me, and I'll try to answer them for you, and other sex therapists will as well. But every patient and every patient's partner can help doctors out in their learning by asking the doctor, "Can we talk about sex? What about our sex life? How will our sex life be affected?" Because honestly, physicians do know information that may help. And so it's a good idea to bring it up. You're doing two things. Number one, you're helping yourself get any sexual information the physician might have. And number two, you're doing a public service. You're getting the doctor used to talking about sex.
Myth number three, once you hit a certain age, people aren't interested in sex anymore.
That myth boogies with the myth that people after cancer aren't interested in sex. So if we do sometimes talk to people about their sex lives in their 20s or 30s, we certainly drop off talking about that after 40. And it's very important to know that people are interested in their sexual life throughout their life. And so somebody who's had a cancer diagnosis and they're in their 60s or 70s or 80s is still going to need information and want information about healthy sexual functioning, even though they're an older adult.
We'll be posting some further resources on mcancer.org/thrive, but generally speaking, how do people find out more about this topic?
You can find information by Googling the words sexual health. If you Google the word sex, it will melt your computer. There are millions and millions and millions of sites that use that word, and it won't necessarily give you healthy information about sex. But if you Google the words sexual health and, then you add the rest, like sexual health and cancer, sexual health and menopause, sexual health and erectile difficulties, then you're much more likely to get a set of information that can be very useful.
Is counseling a good idea?
Yes. Another possibility is to consider meeting with a sex therapist. We have sex therapists at the University of Michigan at the Center for Sexual Health. Sometimes a lot of information and education can be given in one session. We have a special clinic at U of M for people 60 years and over and any sex therapy needs that they have. And they see both a medical physician and a sex therapist who's a mental health professional with a lot of advanced training in sex therapy. And so people who are post-diagnosis, for instance, prostate cancer or breast cancer, might come to our clinic for kind of a full workup around sexual functioning and needs.
Any last advice?
Keep an open mind about the different ways to feel sexual pleasure. If your usual routines have been disrupted, try to be open to new ways, try touching different parts of the body, and any possible way to express caring and enjoyment, remembering that sex is a quality of life issue. Strive for good communication with your partner. Ask, how are you feeling about this? Can we talk about this? Not only with your doctor, but your partner. If you're too embarrassed, then you can start by saying, I listened to a podcast that I'd like you to listen to. Or let's Google Sally Foley and see what information she might have about having a healthy sex life. Every couple's routine is different. Every couple is different. But encouraging good communication and knowing that there isn't just one right way.
How about some homework? What can people do right now to help with this issue?
Now, some people moan the idea of homework exercises brings up school. So if you want, you can call these home play exercises. But a particular home play exercise that people enjoy is to create in their place, in their home, a cuddly nest, a place where they can go to where they might have some Afghans or comforters, that they've created a very cuddly place to sit and massage or cuddle together. The second thing is to do what we call some body mapping with your partner, to take time to touch each other all over your body and then get feedback from the partner about which places feel good to be touched. This is called body mapping, so that you remember she likes to have her elbows touched, she doesn't like to have her knees touched. He likes to have his feet rubbed, he doesn't like to have his scalp rubbed. To do this as an all-over sensory body massage where you gain information. Another thing is a mental exercise to keep telling yourself that you are in the process of establishing a new normalcy. You will have normalcy again in your life. It will be different from your old normal, but it will be normal, and that you're building this right now, that these changes you're going through have been temporarily very disruptive in your life, but they will not last.
To make an appointment with the University of Michigan Center for Sexual Health, please call 734-763-4963. For more information about all cancer topics, please call the Cancer Answer Line at 1-800-865-1125. Thanks for listening. This program is produced in conjunction with Thrive, the patient magazine for the University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center. For more information, visit mcancer.org/thrive.